Films in Focus with David Sterrett is underwritten by The Movie House, your destination for first-run Hollywood and independent movies, and a digital portal to the Met Opera, National Theater Live, and special events worldwide in Millerton, New York, and on the web, themoviehouse.net.
David Sterrett is the editor-in-chief of the Quarterly Review of Film and Video, contributing writer at Cineast, film professor at the Maryland Institute College of Art, and Robin Hood Radio's very own critic. He joins us weekly. The films Colette, First Man, and 22 July. That's actually the beginning of a letter.
I guess it could well be that. Yeah, that's right. Very good. Well, yes, and today we have three films which have something in common, which is to say that they are all based on actual real-life events or situations or people, although those things are very different from one case to the next. So let us begin with Colette. This is directed by and co-written by Wash Westmoreland, whose previous film was a very nice movie starring Julia, called Still Alice, starring Julianne Moore as a woman with Alzheimer's disease. And Westmoreland seems to do well with subjects, movies about women. And here we have a movie about Colette, who was, of course, a very, very well-known French novelist and story writer, who flourished, quite a number of decades ago. And this is basically a biopic. It covers, a slice of her life in the earlier part of the, in the later part of the 19th century, earlier part of the 20th century. It focuses on a period when she was married to Henri Gauthier-Villars, who was himself a writer, and he always used the nom de plume Willie, which is the only way he's ever sort of referred to in the movie. Everybody calls him Willie, including his wife, Colette. She was married to him for quite a while, and it was during that time that she wrote her first four novels, which were about a heroine named Claudine, and they were all published under Willie's name. And this is an interesting little coincidence, because we have right now, this very season in the movies, two films about a famous male writer whose works are being written by his wife. The other one is, of course, the movie called The Wife, which stars Glenn Close. And in this case, we have a real situation. And again, this didn't persist forever. Colette eventually became an enormously famous writer under her own name. But in her earlier career, she was writing this stuff that was getting published under her husband's name. He just couldn't quite hack it. And that, again, is the period of her life with which this movie deals. But it gets far enough into her life that we get a whole lot of other aspects of it. For example, her realizing that she is very bisexual and her starting to have all sorts of lesbian affairs, which her husband thinks is a great idea. And he himself is an enormous libertine and is bounding all over the place and having affairs with women right and left. So we have these very modern people in their sexuality, married to each other, but having all sorts of outside sexual activities. And that's very much a part of the movie. And we see how Colette, who is just sort of boundlessly creative, is not only writing the Claudine novels and other things which are being published under her husband's name until eventually she puts her foot down and starts to get some credit herself, but she also gets involved in acting and in doing some stuff which causes quite a scandal, sort of a pantomime act that she gets involved with. And she hooks up with a very serious female companion, and we had that whole part of her career or her life. And that's what it all covers. So we certainly have lively subject matter here, again, based on real-life stuff, although, of course, very fictionalized for movie purposes. And in this sort of movie, casting is really important. And we have a very fine cast headed by Keira Knightley, who is a wonderful actress and a very, very attractive actress. And she does a wonderful job of playing the young Colette, who has such energy and such creativity and such troubles in her life, which, however, she always manages to surmount because she is just a very, very strong and powerful woman. And we don't get enough of those in the movies, do we now? And Willie is played in a wonderful performance also by Dominic West. Dominic West, of course, I've seen him in any number of things by now, but for me, he will always be first and foremost the star of The Wire, in which he plays a Baltimore cop for all those hours and hours of hours of that very excellent miniseries. And he is, of course, British. And now he is back, well, this isn't the first time, but he is certainly back with his real accent, playing, because even though this is a movie which takes place in France and has French characters. He plays with a very British sort of accent, plays Willie that way. So we have him more in his British persona. So again, with the talents of Keira Knightley and Dominic West at the head of the cast, which is just generally excellent all the way through, it's not a deep movie. It plays this whole story more for sort of bubbly, high spirits than for any sort of deep exploration of what it means to be a pioneering, liberated woman in the earlier part of the 20th century. But it's a very likable movie, and I certainly enjoyed watching it all the way through. I suppose I wish it were a bit deeper, a bit more thoughtful about its subject matter, but it is not a frivolous movie, and it does a very good job of telling the story of a woman who was really quite remarkable. So onward to our next fact-based movie, and this is First Man, and this is now directed by Damien Chazelle, whose earlier films include the, I think, very overrated jazz movie Whiplash, and the somewhat overrated, lavish, splashy musical La La Land, and now he goes here very much into biopic territory himself. As with Colette, we have another biopic here, and this time we are dealing with the story of Neil Armstrong, and First Man does not refer to Adam. It refers to Neil Armstrong, the first man, the first person to set foot on the moon. And this is basically the story of the great space program that stretches over most of the 1960s ended up with the successful flight to the moon. And so obviously other astronauts are key characters in this. But mainly we are really having here again a biopic about Neil Armstrong during this period of his career, starting off with a flight, not a space flight, but another kind of test flight that does not work out very well, and he's afraid that his career might not be going anywhere. Also, right around this time, he suffers a horrible personal tragedy when his little girl dies, and all that is in the very beginning of the movie, and we can see that this is a guy who's had some troubles in his life. But then, to his own surprise, he gets chosen for the astronaut training program for the first batch of astronauts. And he goes through it, and we have a whole lot of the movie deals with that. Not so much with the astronaut training program. This is not a remake of The Right Stuff in any way. It deals more with his personal life. But obviously, since the reason why he is important and of such interest is because of the astronaut training program, so we have a fair amount of that built into the movie. And we see that he is, and this is what people are talking about with the film, and it's an interesting situation. He is an emotionally repressed person, and this is probably one of the things that helps him keep going in the face of things like his little girl dying. And he does not express emotions readily, and this sometimes puzzles and troubles people around him. Sometimes somebody will come up to him when he appears to be suffering some sort of inner turmoil and say, "What's the matter?" And he says, "If I wanted to talk about it, I wouldn't be standing out here in the yard in the middle of the night." And so the person wants to talk to him goes away. So it's an interesting psychological portrait in that respect. Now, Neil Armstrong is played by Ryan Gosling. And Gosling is a good actor, but he's not a very exciting actor. And I think that he doesn't really quite make Neil Armstrong's repressed personality dramatically effective. So it's interesting to sort of watch this and contemplate it. But the movie really gets going when it has what I will call loosely action scenes, such as the space flights, things like that, the test flights, the training flights, things like that that are undergoing. These are filmed very nicely. The movie adheres very much to a Neil Armstrong's point of view sort of structure. And so, for example, in that early flight that I mentioned before, one at the very beginning of the film that does not go well, instead of seeing the craft lifting off and the craft soaring through the sky and then getting into trouble and so forth, what we have is a whole lot of shaky cam stuff. The camera is rigidly held inside the pilot's chamber and shaking and shaking and shaking. And I suppose this is probably more or less what it looked like to the real Neil Armstrong. And it's kind of interesting to look at for a while, but I think the movie kind of overdoes this a bit. It's an interesting sort of effect, and it's done more than once in the movie. But again, the movie's desire not to make this into too much of an epic, too much of a spectacle, works against it, I think, at times. I saw it in IMAX, and I think having that bigness sort of helped its effectiveness. But I have to say, I think it's a movie that's interesting in its restraint, of all things, for a movie on this subject, but doesn't quite become dramatic enough to really sustain full attention throughout its its running time. Interesting movie, but one which I think is not one of the year's very best movies. So turning to our final film for today, 22 July. Oh, this is again based on real life, and it is a very different and far more troubling subject, because we now have a movie which is telling basically the story of the horrific massacre that was carried out in Norway a few years ago by a guy named Anders Behring Breivik, who burst into a, this was all in 2011, just seven brief years ago. He burst into a an island off the coast of Norway, which is sort of a, it was sort of a camp, a summer camp for young people who want to go into government and want to help their country and want to do good things for their country, and who Breivik regarded as just a bunch of privileged twerps. And he decided to make a statement, the sort of right-wing statement that we get in milder forms in other places, such as the United States with Trump, etc. But here we have a full-fledged right-wing terrorist who burst into the summer camp with a gun, well, more than one gun, and murdered 77 of these young, these teenagers and young people at this summer camp, and wounded a whole lot of others. It was just a horrific episode, and of course we all remember hearing about it at the time. And this is a film that delves very much into that. So in the sort of structure that this movie generally tends, this sort of movie generally tends to have, we have Breivik working his way up to the crime. We see his preparations, and he did this in a really horrifying way. He set off an enormous explosive at the Oslo government. That could have killed the prime minister, although it didn't. So this enormous explosive, which itself wiped out an enormous number of people, and with everybody, you know, Norway is not as large as the United States, with so many of the resources now devoted to taking care of this horrifying emergency going on in the city, he is now going out to the island and preparing his massacre there, and then engaging in his massacre there, and whatever resources might have been sent to the island immediately once word got out of what was going on are delayed and are diminished because of what's going on back in Oslo. So in other words, it was a very clever attack in its own horrifying way, or set of attacks, I should say. And then we see him carrying out the horrifying massacre on the island, and then we have the aftermath of the whole thing. He is, and this is again well known, so this is not a spoiler, he is arrested. The cops get to the island before he's killed every single person there, although his hunting expedition is pretty horrifying in the movie. He's arrested, and then he is put on trial, and then he eventually, well, we'll have the aftermath of that, which I won't reveal here in case people don't remember it. So that is what the movie is about. Now, the movie has a couple of other threads to it. It focuses on one of the survivors, who is a teenage boy, who is very, very badly wounded during all of this, brain damage, other stuff goes on, but he survives, and he is able through rehabilitation to get more or less back to a semi-normal state of physical living, although for the rest of his life, apparently, he will have to deal with the idea that because of fragments that remain in his brain of shrapnel and stuff, he could die at any time. But so we see his rehabilitation, and we see his struggling to come to terms, very much a movie about post-traumatic stress, him struggling to come to terms with what happened to him, and then making this huge decision as to whether he is going to testify at Breivik's trial, because a lot of the survivors are going to so testify, and he this would be another trauma for him. And so we have a whole part of the movie is sort of dealing with his decision about whether to do this or not. And then a third strand of the movie very much deals with Breivik's lawyer, a guy who was recruited to be Breivik's lawyer. He doesn't want to be Breivik's lawyer. He doesn't want to defend Breivik. But of course, the principle very much in Norway, as in the United States and many democracies, that everybody deserves a fair defense. He agrees to take this assignment. He agrees to, at, of course, great cost to himself and his family, because all kinds of threats are leveled at them, anonymous calls and death threats and all of that. But he does decide to represent Breivik. He decides to take this assignment reluctantly. And then, of course, he does as best as he can with the assignment. And Breivik doesn't help. At first, there's an insanity offense, which appears to be working pretty well. And then Breivik decides, no, he did this all as a political statement, and he doesn't want people to think that he's insane. And so abruptly, late in the trial, he changes his plea and decides, no, he does not want an insanity defense. And now the lawyer has to cope with all of this. And then we have the final outcome of the whole thing, and that's the end of it. So Paul Greengrass, who directed this movie, is a very, very good director, and his greatest movie came out about a dozen years ago, a movie called United 93, about the famous flight that crashed during the 9/11 attacks. And it's a brilliant movie. It's one of the best docudramas of recent years, a really terrific film. And I don't think 22 July lives up to that. It's not that good, that taut, that completely persuasive from beginning to end. That said, if you're not familiar with this horrific tragedy that took place recently and with the kind of extreme right-wing terrorist thinking that went into it, it's a good movie just as a sort of a primer on that. And it's very dramatic and it's very, very well acted. I particularly want to single out the guy who plays Breivik, an actor named Anders Danielsson-Lea, the largely Scandinavian, almost entirely Scandinavian cast of this movie, so it has that authenticity. And it's a very, very dramatic film, not maybe one of the year's very best, but a very worthwhile look at a very horrifying, recent, and troubling subject. And so that is my semi-documentary drama story this week, Joe.
For which we thank you. David Sterrett, Films in Focus, the films Colette, First Man, and 22 July.